From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. I'll talk with Rebecca Cruz today about Chinese President Xi Jinping's trip through South Asia, as well as an update on Africa's Ebola situation and U.S. pressure to speed up response.
There's a natural inclination to isolate and try to deal with the problem, but that can't happen. Those borders need to be somewhat porous to allow aid workers in, to allow other folks in that can help with the situation.
Later, a conversation with Paul Polak. He started International Development Enterprises 30 years ago, working to ease poverty for nearly 20 million people.
That might be a laudable achievement in some eyes, but compared with 2.7 billion people who live on less than $2 a day, which is 40% of the world's population, that's a drop in the bucket.
Business solutions to poverty, right after this update from NPR News. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Rebecca Cruz, let's talk about two interesting issues this week. First, the Chinese president is taking a tour through South Asia, making first a stop in Sri Lanka, focusing on maritime issues primarily. They have a large port that they've invested in. That relationship, of course, is concerning to his next stop, India. First time visiting any Chinese president has visited India in about 8 years, discussing lots of economic investment, about $100 billion possibly, working on more stable relations for their border. There are some tense relations at their border, the Chinese-Indian border. So what are the implications of this in terms of China's interest in South Asia, expanding their interest to South Asia, focusing, you know, not just on India, the major player in South Asia, but other countries like Sri Lanka?
Yes, I think it's very interesting that he visited Sri Lanka. If we think about, as you mentioned, maritime routes, this has been called the Maritime Silk Road. If you think about China and the number of containers, containerized trade, a topic you and I are quite familiar with, we have a great deal of trade coming from China. And so their maritime routes, how they get those products to the rest of the world, become incredibly important. And if you look at the Indian Ocean, this becomes the main route. Or another concept that's come up is what China is calling a string of pearls, this idea that they are strategically laying out certain ports or investing in certain ports along this route from China all the way to Sudan, where they have infrastructure, they have investment, and can push their products. So that's been very important. Going to Sri Lanka is also significant because if we think about Sri Lanka, their importance has increased in the last, say, 5 to 6 years. Sri Lanka has come out of a civil war that enveloped the country for about 30 years, very, very deadly war, and a bit of a power play in terms of India and China as to who's going to be able to have the most influence there. And the Sri Lankan government, of course, is playing that to their benefit to get the most investment that they can.
Well, I thought it was interesting that during the Chinese president's visit to India, the prime minister of India suggested that there were two kinds of policies in the world, if you will, two kinds of motivations is what it sounded like, that there were expansionistic policies and then there were development policies. There were policies that were meant to expand one's interest, power, influence, and then there were those that were intended to help other countries develop to increase their economic standards and their well-being in this global economy. So he wasn't really, you know, necessarily categorizing the Chinese in one place or another, but I wonder if the visit to India coming on the heels of this visit to Sri Lanka and these clear policies about expanding Chinese interest and influence in the region, if he might be perhaps making some sort of statement about Chinese motivation and whether it was really meant to facilitate development in South Asia or if it was really meant to bolster Chinese position in the region.
It's certainly possible that that's what he meant. I think there are many that would say that over the last couple of decades, China has had concerted efforts to expand their influence in that area, even to South America and other areas. Africa is another continent where we're seeing their involvement. This doesn't mean necessarily that development is hindered. These two things can come side by side. Perhaps as they expand, there will be positive development impacts, and India is certainly hoping to reap the benefits of that. But motivations are probably not necessarily for development purposes from China's point of view.
Well, that's something definitely to watch. Let's go back to this issue of Ebola in West Africa. We haven't talked about this in a few weeks. Of course, this has not gone away. 5,000 cases of the Ebola virus in West Africa, almost 2,500 deaths. the United States has finally stepped up and said, look, we have to do something here.
More nations need to contribute experienced personnel, supplies, and funding that's needed, and they need to deliver on what they pledge quickly. Charities and individual philanthropists have given generously, and they can make a big difference. And so we're not restricting these efforts to governmental organizations. We also need NGOs and private philanthropies to work with us in a coordinated fashion in order to maximize the impact of our response.
The United States actually went so far as to commit military troops on the ground in West Africa to try to limit the expansion of this deadly virus, concerned, of course, that this is going to spread even further outside of that region.
Yes, the United States did that this week. They also called for a special session of the UN Security Council to consider a resolution on encouraging regional neighbors to open their borders and allowing for more aid to get into the country so that these countries that are dealing with this very serious problem are not as isolated. I think there's a natural inclination to isolate and try to deal with the problem, but that can't happen. Those borders need to be somewhat porous to allow aid workers in, to allow other folks in that can help with this situation. So the UN is meeting this week as well, and this is pretty significant. This is only the second or third time that the Security Council has considered a health care situation. In 2000, they looked at AIDS and came up with a resolution to deal with the AIDS epidemic internationally. And so this is significant, and we'll see what happens there. But it's very, very interesting. The president, as you mentioned, are sending in aid workers, but also the military. And there has been a very concerted effort to securitize this to some degree, to make this health care situation a security problem. And the president has mentioned this in his speech this week. This is not just about a health problem in Africa. This could potentially affect their economy, could spread, could lead to far-reaching consequences. And so they're trying to frame this in such a way that we can think about this having effects beyond Africa, affecting us here at home, even if the disease doesn't make it here to the United States.
Well, this is not going away, clearly, and the United States' involvement is only going to grow. And again, you know, paying attention to this issue from that military security perspective is something that we will continue to watch as well. Well, thank you, Rebecca Cruz, as always, for being here with me on Worldviews.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show and answer any questions you may have. You can leave a comment in the Worldviews section of KGOU.org. Or follow us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. You can find me on Twitter as well. I'm at Suzette Grelot, and Rebecca tweets at Cruz226. Next, I'll talk with social entrepreneur Paul Polak about using economic principles to fight poverty. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. Today, I'm joined by Paul Polak. For the past 30 years, he worked to bring millions of the world's poorest people out of poverty. He started the nonprofit International Development Enterprises in 1981 to provide irrigation technology to farmers and give them more access to crops. In 2009, the Atlantic Monthly named him one of 25 brave thinkers, along with President Obama and Apple founder Steve Jobs. His most recent book, The Business Solution to Poverty, came out just over a year ago and argues that governmental and philanthropic efforts to end poverty haven't been as effective as free market incentives could be. Paul Polak, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me here.
You started your career as a psychiatrist and spent a number of years, a couple of decades as a psychiatrist, and this somehow influenced the work that you did then with the poor. How did you make that connection between your work with mentally ill and homeless veterans and people in need of psychiatric treatment to then working with the poor?
The reason I got into this space is as a psychiatrist, I was working with major mental illness, the kind of people that normally go to the state hospital. And what we learned very quickly is that their adjustment depended more on their extreme poverty, that is, the members of the population that were chronically mentally ill. Some of them were homeless, and some of them were chronically mentally ill living in the community, their poverty was a bigger determinant of their adjustment than their symptoms of mental illness. Some people would have active hallucinations while they were working, and they were excellent workers. Some people who weren't as flagrantly psychotic seemed to be better adjusted, but they couldn't work worth a lick. So we started doing poverty strategies for the chronically mentally ill living in the community. Things like opening access to Section 8 housing by becoming a housing authority. The state mental health authority could, under a loophole in the law, become a housing authority and apply for Section 8 rent subsidies. So we made Section 8 rent subsidies available to chronically mentally ill people so they could now, under a Section 8, they contribute a quarter of their income, and the HUD subsidy provides the rest. So they were eligible for nice apartment houses with swimming pools. Never had anything like that before in their life. And we used that as a lever to help them move out of poverty, because in order to gain entry into that program, they had to agree to move their butt off the sofa watching TV and come in for some kind of work. So we set up a whole system of semi-sheltered work settings, a system of residential settings, and access to work and self-esteem and income was the most powerful factor in decreasing readmission rates, for instance. So I was interested in, became interested in poverty strategies, and quickly realized that the people who were poor in Southwest Denver were living on $500 or $600 a month, and there were people in Bangladesh living on $30 a month. So I have a lot of curiosity. I went to Bangladesh and talked to those people, much like I did to people who were patients in the mental health system. And they quickly told me in Bangladesh that they were poor because they didn't have enough money. And they made most of their money from farming on small one-acre farms. And what they needed most to earn more income is affordable irrigation. So I talked to a bunch of people all over the place, found that first a rower pump, which was pumped by a rowing motion, and then a treadle pump, was a very effective for affordable irrigation. So I never looked back. I ended up, that was so interesting for me. So we then that led to starting a project to mass market treadle pumps in Bangladesh, which started me on the path of mass marketing affordable irrigation using market creation strategies. We ended up helping 20 million people move out of poverty. And that got me interested in the whole thing about market solutions and business solutions to poverty.
I'm speaking with social entrepreneur Paul Polak about his work using economic principles to fight global poverty. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest this half hour is social entrepreneur Paul Polak, the author of the book, The Business Solution to Poverty. He started his career as a psychiatrist, and when we left off, he described how a trip to Bangladesh sparked an interest in providing affordable irrigation to farmers and launched his vision using market solutions to combat global poverty. It's interesting to hear you say, as we were kind of started out saying, you're a pioneer in social entrepreneurship. I mean, that concept didn't really exist at the time, but you chose, after this trip to Bangladesh, you chose to employ business and market strategies to fight poverty, whereas many people choose aid and assistance and other types of strategies to fight poverty. Why is it that a business model and a market strategy, and you know, is preferable or somehow superior to other types of models to fight poverty? Or was there, you know,
mindset. I was open to anything. But it's simply that the charity models didn't work with treadle pumps specifically. We started with rower pump, a simple pump like a sump pump with a 2-inch plastic tube and a plunger. And there were 7 or 8 NGOs promoting Roer pumps. They usually subsidized either the drilling of the well or the cost of the treadle pump, and the strategy was that poor people are really poor, so they need to have something cheaper. But the mechanism by which you could mass disseminate Roer pumps and treadle pumps involved local workshops that made them, dealers who sold them, and well drillers who drilled the well. Now, if you paid for the cost of drilling the well, you put well drillers out of business. And well drillers, there are about 3,000 of them that we trained in Bangladesh, acting in their own self-interest, are much more powerful marketing strategy than paying for the cost of well drilling. If you subsidize the cost of the Roer pump or the treadle pump, you put manufacturers out of business. And while that was an advantage to the few people you could subsidize, in the big picture, it really limited the number of people who could get pumps. So the question is, you want to help a few people by paying for their equipment, or do you want to help a million people by activating local entrepreneurial networks to act in their own self-interest to manufacture, market, and install treadle pumps? Obviously, and many experiences that I've had, when you give things away, they don't get used properly. So it ended up, based on practical experience, being what I consider to be the most effective way of changing people's lives through access to affordable technologies and strategies. Far more effective than trying to donate people out of poverty.
So providing affordable access and technologies and providing this access, you've largely focused on farmers and farming practices in your work. Is there a particular reason why? Is this just where you got your start? Or, I mean, water in general is where you focus, safe drinking water, safe use of water, but largely so that they can farm and enhance their productivity. And your work has allowed farmers to increase their income by hundreds of millions of dollars if you collectively add it all together. So why farming? Why is that the key area?
IDE, which is the organization that I started, its mission was to increase the income of people who live on a dollar a day. At that time, there were 1.1 billion of those. About 75 or 80% lived on farms. They're primarily rural. And if you look at the 2.7 billion people who live on less than $2 a day, they're primarily rural, not urban. So it was simply started with farmers because that's where population is. And in fact, when you look at the big picture, 85% of all the farms in the world are less than 5 acres. So we get a very distorted view of farming because in the West, we think of kind of farms that live, farms that exist in the West. They're not typical. On the global scene, farms are small and getting smaller. In the West, they're big and getting bigger. And by the way, that was the focus of IDE. So I founded that organization, led it for 25 years, handed it over. And then now I'm going to the next scale level, because my view is that 20 million people who we help move out of poverty, who are primarily one-acre farmers, that might be a laudable achievement in some eyes, but compared with 2.7 billion people who live on less than $2 a day, which is 40% of the world's population, that's a drop in the bucket. So now I'm moving to the next level of scale, and I'm creating, IDE was a nonprofit operating as a business. I'm now in the last 4 years creating global companies, each of which can transform the livelihoods of 100 million $2 a day customers if the company is successful, generate 10 billion in revenues, and earn enough profits to attract international commercial investment. I'm starting four of those companies. The first is drinking water. The second is affordable electricity for villages. There's a billion people, more than a billion people without access to safe drinking water, more than a billion people without who will never connect to the electric grid. So what we've done there is activate a design team, a global design team, led by space engineers at Ball Aerospace, to cut the cost of photovoltaics by 80%, because photovoltaics are divisible. And so that's a big advantage in dealing with small and large villages and different uses for electricity. A third company that I'm starting creates a green, low-carbon emission competitor to coal and charcoal by transforming agricultural waste and invasive species of plants through a process called torrefaction, which is sort of early pyrolysis. That's a potential $250 billion market. Coal is responsible for 40% of global carbon emissions. We burn 6 billion tons of coal every year on the planet. We produce 4 billion tons of agricultural waste. About a quarter of that is transformable into a thermally competitive alternative to coal. So I think there's a billion tons of ag waste and at least another billion tons of invasive species of plants that could be transformed into a product that competes with coal and charcoal. In the process, that's a $250 billion market. And those ag wastes are located right where the poor people are. So that's very much relevant to poor people. So those are the kinds of companies that I'm starting now. And a group of us are exploring setting up a investment fund. I'm creating four of those companies. I think there's a fairly high risk that at least two or three of them will be successful. And then we're exploring setting up an investment fund of about $130 million that will create 20 more of those companies.
Well, my goodness, there's still an awful lot of work to do. You've taken 20 million people out of poverty, and yet, unfortunately, there's still a lot of people there, and you've got a lot of work to do. Well, I thank you so much, Paul Polak, for being with us today and sharing with us the important work that you're doing. It's very interesting.
Thank you very much. This is one of the quickest 15 minutes I've experienced. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. You've been listening to my conversation with Paul Polak about finding ways to end poverty using business principles. We have an excerpt of his book, The Business Solution to Poverty, on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews as part of a collaboration with the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our digital content producers are Sarah Hurd and Hallie Arias. Symphony Swift prepares the research for our interviews and books our guests. And Brian Hardzinski produces the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Perlotte.